Let's start with our motivation. So we've been in the BBCs talking a little bit about the self-centered thought. And by the way, do not translate it as self-cherishing thought, because that gives the wrong idea that we shouldn't cherish ourselves and that we should hate ourselves and beat ourselves up, and that's not correct at all. So please translate it as self-centered thought and think of it as self-centered thought. And how when it comes on, it's quite strong and it says, I need this. And so, of course, there's the differences between needs and wants. But that doesn't matter much to the self-centered thought when it arises, because every want becomes a need, whether it is one or not. But it's very difficult to fulfill all of our wants and to fulfill all of our needs also. With NVC, we're learning some skills, how to learn, you know, how to fulfill our own needs. But still, we're not always successful. And so we need to learn, and I think this is a skill that everybody in samsara has to learn. And this is what fortitude means. We have to learn to have fortitude in the face of not getting what we want or not getting what we need, or of experiencing suffering or unpleasant things. When the self-centered thought is manifest, I don't know about you, but my self-centered thought says, if I don't get this, the world is going to end, or nearly. Yeah, so my need, my want is like all-consuming, and there's this idea that if I don't get it, I'm going to have incredible suffering. And even though I might look at it and say, well, you know, it's not such incredible suffering, but still, I don't want that suffering at all. Because really, it is incredible suffering, because it's my suffering. So I find it helpful at those times to step back and ask myself, what is going to happen if I don't get what I want, if I don't get what I need? What is realistically actually going to happen? When I ask that question, it becomes clear how inflated my afflicted mind has made the situation. Because I can see that I'm imagining all sorts of horrible things, and I'm imagining that I have no resources to deal with those horrible things. So on two accounts, I'm just transfixed by the possibility of the suffering that's going to come from not getting what I want. But really, when I look at that stuff quite clearly and ask myself, is it really going to be that bad? Is it true that you're going to fall apart and the earth is going to disintegrate? Then the answer is clearly no. And at that time, I find it helpful to recall all the many times in my life that I haven't gotten what I've wanted, what I've needed, and I've lived through every single one of them. And when I look back, most of them, I thought the suffering was going to be terrible. But looking back on it now, it was like, no, it wasn't that bad. So doing that gives me more confidence that, you know, it wasn't that really that bad in the past. And so it's not going to be that awful right now, too, if self-centered thought has some frustration. Yeah, I can survive this. So in this way, whether we're craving for sense objects in the desire realm or craving for our own liberation, either way we come to see that the self-centered attitude is really out of place. Doesn't make much sense. And so we let it go. And then that, of course, gives us so much mental space to consider the situation of others and develop compassion for all sentient beings. And so motivated by that compassion, may we seek full Buddhahood. And may what we do this evening together be one drop in the bucket leading to that aim. So do you find that your self-centeredness works like that? Just everything that happens to me becomes a crisis. When I really look at it, you know, even if I have some expectation of how I want things to go, if it doesn't go that way, it's okay. You know, it may be a little inconvenient, but it's okay. Anyway, what else is new? When have I always succeeded in getting my way? And getting what I want and having what I expect happen. So thinking in that way kind of evens the mind out a little bit. Yeah. So, you know, our famous spatula. You know, I mean, there's the toilet paper teaching and there's the spatula teaching. Yeah, I haven't done the toilet paper teaching in a while. But, you know, the spatula is not where we want it to be. Yeah, it's okay. It's where somebody else wanted it to be. And eventually we'll find it and we'll use it and the world will continue. Yeah. So the same thing, the toilet paper teaching was given from a different viewpoint, from actually fulfilling the wishes for others. Yeah, that, you know, when you're sitting there and you turn for some toilet paper and the roll is empty because the person who was there before you use the last bit and did not put a new roll of toilet paper on. And you're sitting and you're compromised at that moment. Yeah. So one part of the story is, okay, you'll live. Yeah, you'll live. A little inconvenient, a little messy, but you'll live. Okay. But the second part, the real purpose of the story is when you're the person who uses up the last piece of toilet paper, out of compassion for the person who's going to come after you, put the new roll in. You know, it's like we say, I want to become Buddhas in order to benefit other sentient beings, and yet we're too lazy to put a new roll of toilet paper in when the old roll's done. How are we ever going to become a Buddha if we can't do that? You know, we have to start with the little things that are manageable that we can do in 15 seconds, you know, and then we build up our capacity to benefit others based on that. Okay, but we got to start somewhere. So, did you make syllogisms from last week? Good. Venerable Jampa sent us some syllogisms too. Yeah, she's following everything quite well. So, who wants to start? You have something you want to start with?
So this one is, attachment exaggerates the positive qualities of a person or object and is suffering. So the subject is attachment.
Where's the because?
Pardon?
You need a because.
I need a because.
Yeah, for it to be a syllogism, you need a because.
Attachment exaggerates positive qualities.
Because it is suffering.
Well, it's actually suffering because it exaggerates.
Yeah. It's suffering, okay, because it exaggerates.
Okay. Does attachment exaggerate? The attachment is the response to the distorted attention. The distorted attention is the one that exaggerates it.
Next.
Okay, next one.
I started simple on the correct effect signs. A deer has passed by the barn because there are freshly made deer prints in the new snow. So the property of the subject, a deer has made deer prints in the new snow. A deer has made freshly made deer prints in the new snow. The pervasion is whatever makes freshly made deer prints in the new snow
if
there are freshly made deer prints in the new snow necessarily. A deer is a subject, has passed by the barn is the predicate. Because there are freshly made deer prints in the new snow. I was trying to get this cause and effect idea here.
Yeah.
But the predicate doesn't hold in the pervasion.
Yeah, because a deer having passed by the barn doesn't mean that something... I mean, what you're trying... Yeah.
New prints by the barn? Yeah, freshly made deer prints in the snow.
No, or how about... Take the space in front of the barn. Yeah. A deer has walked by there because they're freshly made.
Okay.
Deer prints there. So then your subject would be the space in front of the barn. There are freshly made deer prints. And the pervasion would be, if there are freshly made deer prints, then
a deer has passed.
Then a deer has passed by.
Okay.
So make it like the one on that hilltop. Oh, there is fire because there is smoke. So it's in the space in front of the barn.
Freshly made deer prints.
No, a deer has walked by.
Because there are deer prints in that
freshly
new snow by the barn.
Yeah. So then the cause is there being fresh near deer prints in the snow by the barn, and the result is
That's the effect.
No.
The deer is the cause.
Yeah. No, wait a minute. No, you're going, because easy. There's the effect of the new deer prints, then there must have been the cause,
the deer.
Walking in front of the barn.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, but the subject is your syllogism, is that space in front of the barn.
The space in front of the barn. A deer has passed because there are freshly made prints in that deer prints in that snow, in that space by the barn.
Yeah.
I thought this was going to be an easy one. Okay.
Go think about the one about the smoke and the fire. You know, there's the result, the smoke, so then there's the fire. But the subject is on that
Smoky Mountain Pass.
Yeah.
Okay. So on the area by the barn, a deer has passed by because there are freshly made deer prints in the snow at that area by the barn.
Yeah.
This one's quite similar. The subject, in the forest, there was a cougar because there are cougar tracks in the snow.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say the yard, but I didn't want to give Venerable Neva a heart attack. So the subject is the forest.
Yeah. You may want to specify this area in the forest.
So there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise there's a deer in the forest, you know. A deer has been in the forest.
A cougar, yeah.
Looking for Venerable Nima.
Okay, but yeah, I had looked at one of the other ones and saw how to rearrange that, because I started out the same way that Venerable Senki did, and it wasn't working.
Yeah.
Wow. I was looking at the cause and effect so strong, that's why.
Okay, someone else? Yeah?
And just to comment, when I went back through my Pravana Vartika notes, and this thing about the way he has it, on the mountain pass there is fire because there is billowing smoke, is also not accurate. He needs to have a smoky mountain pass.
Yeah.
To designate it. But
right.
Yeah, so you were right in saying that, but it's not that way in the example.
Yeah, unless you say on that mountain pass.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so you have to know which mountain pass you're talking about.
So I have to see if this one actually works. It might be a combo that doesn't. But consider the subject, the snowy garden. It is too soon to plant tomatoes because the ground is frozen.
Okay, so then what's...
So the property of the subject, the snowy garden, the ground is frozen. The ground is frozen, it is necessarily too soon to plant tomatoes.
That would work.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to make sure that you're specifying that the ground is frozen in that garden.
In that garden.
Yeah.
Because the ground, okay. So consider the subject, the snowy garden. It is too soon to plant tomatoes because the ground in that garden is frozen.
Yeah. Or in that garden, you're pointing to where it is. So they know what you're talking about.
Got it.
Okay. Not just in a garden, any old garden. That wouldn't work.
And then after your challenge of yesterday, consider the subject an ordinary being, Tipton Chinni. She can generate endless merit because she is a dependent arising.
check that one out and see.
The ordinary being is a dependent arising.
Okay.
No. Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
A dependent arising can necessarily generate endless merit. Its consciousness is a dependent arising.
Any old dependent arising. The computer's a dependent
arising.
That's
what I mean. Okay. So because her consciousness is... Here's the other one. No. We'll stick with that one. Because that consciousness can generate dependent arising. So consider the subject an ordinary consciousness. It can generate endless merit because that consciousness is a dependent arising.
An ordinary consciousness. What about if the person's angry?
An ordinary person, because their consciousness is a dependent arising.
Now, they're an ordinary person,
can generate merit endlessly because their consciousness is a dependent arising.
So if your consciousness is a dependent arising, you can generate endless merit. Yes, but you certainly need a lot of other causes.
Yeah, this is just sort of basic.
You know, does every consciousness that's a dependent arising have the possibility of creating endless merit? Every consciousness, can a grasshopper's consciousness create any endless merit?
The general lie of the whole thing, sure.
Yeah, you need to specify that. You need to get that in there somehow. Otherwise, you're saying the grasshopper. Yeah. Maybe the continuum. Take the continuum of an ordinary sentient being. Is merit because
that mental consciousness is a dependent arising. Mm-hmm. I found it reassuring.
Okay. Yeah, it would probably be good to add in there, you know, because it's a dependent arising. If the consciousness is a dependent arising, if the continuum of a consciousness is a dependent arising, then that consciousness, then the continuum of that consciousness can create endless merit. Yes. You have to talk about continuums here.
Saying it's a dependent arising, not all dependent.
Yeah, you can't just say because
most dependent arisings can't create anything.
Right. No, they can create things, but they can't create merit. That's why you have to say because it's the continuum is a dependent arising. Because it's a, you know,
the mental continuum of an ordinary being,
the subject, can create endless merit because it is a continuum. That is
mental
continuum that is a dependent arising.
Right.
Because
of being a continuum that is.
Because of being a continuum that is a dependent arising. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Good. Yeah.
So I have a question with correct effect science. Does the predicate have to be the predicate's the cause? And the sign is the effect.
Not always. He gave an example about that on that island at night. What was it? There is no smoke because there is no fire. It was a non-object.
I noticed that had to be negative in order for that to work.
The non-observation.
The absence of fire.
Yeah.
Because fire doesn't prove smoke, but the absence of fire proves no smoke.
Right. Right. There's two things. One is if it's a non-observation sign, which was that example, mm-hmm. where you could use the non-existence of the cause to prove the non-existence of the result. But generally, if it's a cause and effect one, you use the existence of the effect to prove the cause. Because if there's an effect, there must have been a cause. If there is a cause, there's not necessarily an effect. Okay, that's if you're looking at the effect things. But remember, there's the three kinds of reasoning. So if it's a non-observation one, so if you... He gave that example. I don't quite agree with it because there could be a fire on the other side. There could be smoke on the other side that you're not seeing. But at least you could say, on this side of the island and the river at night, there is no smoke because there is no fire. Okay, that's a non-observation sign. Because if there were fire, then you should observe smoke. Yeah?
You wouldn't necessarily see the smoke at night.
Yeah, but you should be able to see the fire at night. So by not observing the fire, then you could show that there's no smoke.
I was just wondering about the two examples because the, like, it's too early to plant tomatoes because the ground is frozen. Mm-hmm. The ground is frozen would seem to be the cause, and the effect would seem to be too soon to plant tomatoes. So, but the cause was the sign, and the effect was the
But if you don't have the cause, which is the right temperature, then you're never going to get the effect.
But the cause was the sign.
Again, it's the lack of frozen ground is showing the lack of conditions.
So it's a non-observation.
It's a non-observation. Say the whole syllogism again.
I wonder if it was an observation.
In that garden.
In that snowy garden, it is too soon to plant tomatoes because that ground in the garden is frozen.
Mm-hmm. So the ground being frozen in the garden is a cause.
Yes.
Yeah. And then it's going to bring the effect of it being too early to plant tomatoes.
Yeah.
But what Venerable Love is
saying
is it's supposed to
be
the other way around. Yeah, but you're saying it's too early to plant, or you cannot plant tomatoes, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. What? Change it to.
Yeah.
You cannot plant tomatoes.
Yeah, I think it is a one of non-observation, because it doesn't work the other way around. You can't change it. Say, in the snowy ground, the ground is frozen because you can't plant tomatoes.
No.
No.
No, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
I don't see how that's non-observation because there's no negative in the subject.
The negative in the predicate is you can't plant tomatoes. Mm. Yeah, it's too early to plant tomatoes, meaning at this time you cannot plant tomatoes.
But it is.
Or tomatoes won't grow, actually. You know, at this spot in the garden. Tomatoes won't grow because the ground is frozen.
So predicate negatives not the sun.
In that spot in the garden, tomatoes will not grow.
That's the predicate.
Because
the ground is frozen.
So in that spot in the garden, the ground is frozen. If the ground is frozen there, tomatoes will not grow. That's the best way to do it. And then you have to deduce, if tomatoes won't grow, then it's because, you know, in that spot in the garden, tomatoes won't grow because it's too early to plant them. You have to make the link there that because the tomatoes won't grow, then it's useless to plant them. You can still plant them, but you can't. Oh, that's true. You can't plant them. Okay.
I just wonder if the wording is too early. Is that to be taken as a negative necessarily?
I think it's better to reword it as at that place in the garden, tomatoes will not grow.
So that wording would be important when you're making the syllogism.
Yeah, I think that wording would be important. Yeah, because what you have to deduce is if tomatoes won't grow, it means that it's too early to plant them. Yeah. So somebody has to realize that. Yeah, somebody may, oh yeah, tomatoes won't grow because the ground is frozen, but we can still plant them. Yeah. So somebody could say that, then you have to. Yeah. Well, no, you can't get to. You have to get to the ground.
But you. But it's really good to plant. Put it out in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the ground's not frozen then.
Yeah, but it just sits there. Till
yeah.
Spring.
Yeah, but that's that's not part of our syllogism. It's good technique, but it's not part of the syllogism. Yeah.
So the subject, the mental factor of feeling, is an omnipresent mental factor because it always accompanies a main mind.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It's a nature, an example of the nature.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good one. You want to hear some of Venerable Jhampa's?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So she started out with the correct signs of non-observation. She gave three of them, because remember the homework was three. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the subject, hair on teeth, which is apparently, she said it's a German expression. It's like, you know, a mustache on a turtle, the hair on your teeth. Okay, so hair on your teeth are non-existent because they are not products. Okay, so hair on your teeth is a non-product. Okay, it's not a product. And if it's a non-product, it's necessarily non-existent. Is that correct? No. No, because why? What's an example of something that's not a product? Uncompounded space, true cessation. Okay. An apple is not inherently produced because it's produced by causes and conditions. This is a non-observation sign. How does that sound to you? Yeah. Okay. A person is not independent because she is the result of many causes and conditions. Yeah. Person is not independent because she is the result of many causes and conditions. What's the property?
She is the cause of many causes and conditions.
No. What's the subject?
A person.
A person. Predicate. Not independent. Reason.
Causes.
Yes, because she's the product of many causes and conditions. So the property person is the result of many causes and conditions. That's true. And then the pervasion.
Is the product of causes and conditions is necessarily non-independent. Yes.
That's right. Okay, that one's good. Okay, then she did some correct nature signs. Oh, the subject, object and subject, exists simultaneously because they are of the same nature. That's the Chittamatra view. Yeah, she specifies that in the syllogism. So she said, this example is interesting. I don't think it will hold because if you apply the counter-privation, whatever is not existing simultaneously is necessarily not of the same nature. But even then it should be the same with, if it is of the same nature, it should necessarily exist simultaneously. So for Chittamatran, subject and object, that's true for them. But for the rest of us, are subject and object the same nature? Why not? Yeah, why aren't subject and object the same nature?
Are you thinking a subject and its object?
Yeah.
In that case, they're cause and effect and they don't exist at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
But subject and object in general can exist at the same time.
At the same time, yeah. I think it's meaning subject and its object, or object and its subject. So to be one nature, things have to exist at the same time. To be cause and effect, they have to not exist at the same time.
What precedes what in that relationship?
In cause and effect, which comes first?
Well, subject and object?
In subject and object, what comes first? If you're perceiving something, which comes first? Your mind perceiving it or the object? Which causes which?
Aren't they a dependent arising?
Yeah, they're a dependent arising, but that doesn't mean that they exist at the same time.
Well, like it's the act of observation. It's a subject and an object coming together, right? That's what produces the
Now we're talking about the subject being the mind cognizing the cat and the cat. Okay? Do those two things exist at the same time? Really? So one doesn't cause the other.
Okay, so it's the mind perceiving the cat, not just the mind.
No, it's the mind perceiving the cat.
Okay.
Yeah, which one comes first? The mind that perceives the cat or the cat? The object. Yeah, because you need to have an object that is, you know, that connects with your faculty that then cause the consciousness, the perceiving consciousness to arise.
But doesn't the consciousness depend on an object to arise?
That's the point. Yeah, the mind perceiving the cat depends on the object, the cat, to arise.
Okay.
Okay. If you're talking valid minds and valid objects, then we say those depend on each other in general because you establish them in relationship to each other. But generally, if we're perceiving something, yeah, for me to perceive something, there's got to be a cause for me to perceive, right? I mean, my perception, my visual consciousness, seeing the cat, doesn't arise out of nothing, does it? It arises out of causes. So what are the causes for my visual consciousness that sees the cat?
The eye organ,
and what else?
The cat.
So which comes first, the cat or the visual consciousness perceiving it? Which one's the cause of which?
Well, generally speaking, it's the cat, but I just remember hearing teachings where, you know, there.
Yeah, no, what you're getting confused about is when we talk about establishing reliable subjects and reliable objects, we say that they depend on each other. They're established in relationship to each other. But that has nothing to do. Being established in relationship to each other doesn't mean that they have to be simultaneous. Yeah, there's two kinds of relationship. Okay, one is the relationship of being the same nature. Yeah, like the color of the book and the book. And two things that are of the same nature exist simultaneously. Because if one doesn't exist, the other doesn't exist. Cause and effect is the other kind of relationship. And cause and effect, you know, a cause and its effect, or an effect and its cause, cannot exist at the same time. You always have to have the cause before you have the effect of that cause. Don't you? You have to plant the seed before you have the sprout that comes from the seed. You don't have the plant and then plant the seed for it. Okay? I mean, this thing of cause coming before effect, this is how we run our whole lives. We make our decisions to do a certain act to bring about a certain effect. if that effect already happened, then you don't need the cause. Okay? Think about it some. Okay?
Yeah. I was going to ask a question that I
may be mistaken, but is that the view of the Prasangikas? Because if I remember correctly, in the mind-only school, don't they say that the subject, that the mind and the subject arise at the same time?
Yeah. That's why the subject and its object, or the objects and its subject, yeah, that's why she said exists simultaneously because they are of the same nature. And then she puts in parentheses Chittamatra view. And she says, this example is interesting. I don't think it will hold because and then she gives this thing up, the counter-pervasion. But if the counter-pervasion doesn't hold, the pervasion's not going to hold either. Okay. Here she has, some things don't exist simultaneously but are still of the same nature. Oh, Nahir, okay. Now, this is interesting. For example, Tupten Jampa's future corpse and her body today are of the same nature. Okay? And then she puts in parentheses, they're the same nature because they're made of similar elements and are of a transient nature.
No.
Being... just because two things are made of similar ingredients doesn't mean they're the same nature. Okay, a cake made with raisins, you know, or a cake made with flour and over here, and the pie made of flour over there. Yeah, they aren't the same nature, just because they're made out of flour. Yeah, so. Yeah, this is something too important because for things to be of the same nature, they have to exist at the same time. If you eat the pie, you can still have the cake. And if you eat the cake, you can still have the pie. So this is much better than having your cake and eating it too. You have a pie and a cake. Then you can eat one and save the other. Okay. Okay, so this is important to understand about one nature, okay? It doesn't mean that they're made of the same type of stuff, okay?
Future corpse is not yet a material object, so they're not even made of the same thing. One is a mental...
Abstract composite. A future object is a, it's not a form, is it? It's a Demanduce, a abstract composite. Yeah. Okay, here's another one. The subject, a good practitioner, set the conditions for a precious human life. I think she means has the conditions for a precious human life. Because she is practicing ethical conduct, or maybe she means a good practitioner is creating the conditions for a future precious human life. Because she is practicing ethical conduct, the six perfections, and making prayers. Okay. So subject, good practitioner, predicate.
It
causes for a precious human. Okay, reason. Right, okay. Then the property. Yeah, someone practicing those things. Okay, then. Pervasion.
Whoever is practicing ethical conduct, six paramitas, and aspirational prayers necessarily creates the conditions for a future precious human reader.
No.
Nice.
Okay. First, I think you have to specify prayers for a special human rebirth, or prayers for awakening. It can't be just any old prayers. You know, like the prayer, may I win the lottery or something. Okay. Yeah. Now the question is, okay, so that person's creating the conditions for precious human life. What about if you made it the subject, a good practitioner will attain a precious human life because she is practicing ethical conduct, six perfections, and making prayers for a precious human life?
Questionable.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah. The person is creating the causes for that. Whether they will have that, what could interfere? Yeah. Or destroying your virtue, yeah, by anger, destroying. I mean, that, because that karma will eventually ripen, okay? So you can't just say because anger arises at the moment of death, because maybe that karma doesn't ripen in the very next life, it ripens beyond that. But if you want to say it's never going to ripen, then you have to say it was destroyed, and that's by anger and wrong views.
Maybe you could go with will ripen as long as you're not specifying that it's the very next life.
Right. Well, you can't even say it will ripen because somebody can destroy their merit. Yeah? We do it all the time. Yeah?
Not using the word will is important.
Yeah. Or you, whether you use it or don't use it.
But she said create the conditions. Right?
Yeah. But yeah, the way she put it, yes, you are creating the conditions. But I asked the question, if you create the conditions, do you necessarily have that? And the answer is no, because it's possible to destroy your conditions.
So how about putting the word me?
Yeah, yeah, might. But then that doesn't tell you much, does it? It's like, well, maybe. Okay. Then the 11th Panchen Lama is missing because his whereabouts are unknown. What do you think about that?
Somebody knows, might know his whereabouts.
Yeah. So what's missing? What doesn't? What doesn't? What isn't the syllogism fulfilling? Which part of it? There's either it's not fulfilling the property or it's not fulfilling the pervasion. Which is it that it's not the property? Because some people know where he is. Well, of course, I'm sure he doesn't live alone on a desert island where nobody knows where he is. There's people who bring him food, you know. I'm sure there's some people who know where he is. Otherwise, he would...
He's alive.
Yeah.
And the people that knew where he is are alive.
Yeah. Well, no, if somebody's alive,
somebody knows
they're alive. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's alive.
Yeah. Okay. Then here's another one. The subject, sentient beings, are bound in cyclic existence because of the law of cause and effect. Sentient beings are bound in cyclic existence because of the law of cause and effect. Yeah, sentient beings, yeah, because of the law of cause and effect. Or even if you said sentient beings are bound in cyclic existence because of being under the influence of cause and effect. What's not right about that? What's the subject? Predicate. Existence. Reason. Put in because of being under the influence of the law of cause and effect. Okay. Then.
The bigger circle is the wrong one.
Hmm?
The bigger circle is the wrong one.
Oh, you got to say something more. What isn't working?
The sign is size of the circle that the sign would make.
Yeah, the circle of being under the law of cause and effect, and being bound in cyclic existence. Which one's bigger?
The sign, and that's wrong.
There's no provision.
Yeah, there's no provision.
You could flip it; it might work.
Yeah. Well, if you flip it, the sentient beings are under the influence of the law of cause and effect because they are bound in cyclic existence. So if something, sentient beings are bound in cyclic existence, okay, if something is bound in cyclic existence, are they necessarily under the influence of cause and effect? Some people say yes, some people say no. What is it?
Yes.
Yeah, they are under the influence.
What Venerable Thakur was saying, correct, that the provision is backwards.
Yeah. No, but here we just switch the two things. Yeah. Okay. So the subject, Tupdenjampa, is in the nature of dukkha because she is subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. She is a person subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. No, Tupdenjampa is in the nature of dukkha. Okay, because she is a person subject to birth, aging, sickness, and death. What do you think? Yeah, it works. Okay. The subject, Tupdenjampa, experienced some unhappy results because she did some actions with a destructive motivation. Tupdenjampa experienced some unhappy results because she did some actions with a destructive emotion. If somebody does some actions with a destructive emotion, do they necessarily experience unhappy results?
No.
Yes or no?
No.
Why not? Because you can purify. So you would have to say Tupdenjampa experienced some unhappy results because she did some actions with a destructive emotion and did not purify them. You have to add that other bit. Otherwise, the privation doesn't work.
And actually, I don't know about the time frame, but you would have to say that the predecessor of Tupdenjampa did a negative action. I mean that
right.
Tupdenjampa felt and experienced unhappy results because the predecessor didn't purify.
Yeah, because the person in the previous can
then there would be no property of the subject.
Hmm?
If you did that, then there'll be no property of the subject because Tupdenjampa, because the predecessor did the action.
Right.
So then that still wouldn't work.
Yeah. But sometimes when we say, like, Tupdenjampa, we mean this life. Sometimes we mean the continuum.
Yeah.
But we just say the same words, even though we're meaning something different by the same words. Because we say, oh, so-and-so died, and they were reborn as a whatever, as if it was the same person being reborn. We say that, and everybody understands it. But literally, it's not correct. Because, you know, it's a different person that is reborn. You have to say, you know, so-and-so, the continuum of so-and-so was reborn.
So can we play this through
the whole thing? Okay. So Tupdenjampa experienced some unhappy, we can say Tupdenjampa experienced some unhappy results because her continuum in a previous life did some actions with a destructive emotion and those actions were not purified.
You could just say someone in
the
continuum.
Yeah.
Or you could say
Tipton Jampa, the continuum of Tipton Jampa experienced some unhappy results because she had seeds of negativity in her continuum. That puts it all in the same life.
Or if you say, you could say Tipton Jampa of this life experienced some unhappy results because in her previous continuum, you know.
In her current continuum, she had some seeds of...
Oh, she had some seeds, yeah. She had some seeds, yeah. Implying that you have the seeds because you created the actions. Yeah. That would work. Okay. Anybody else want to go through? Yeah. Yeah, it's good. I mean, do you find you're learning a lot by going through these? Yeah. I mean, we're learning Dharma, but we're also learning to think clearly. Yeah, do you see that? How it's really making you think clearly and exactly what you need to say to communicate well? And then, you know, it's then hopefully that will apply, because so often we can see we have misunderstandings because we use words and we assume that other people know what we mean and we're not being clear. Yeah? And so really helping us to be more specific about things. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this one works, but I was trying to be a correct sign of non-observation. The subject, a person who has had a direct realization of emptiness, will not take rebirth in the lower realms because they have eliminated the cause for lower rebirths.
Because they've eliminated the causes.
Cause for lower rebirth. For lower rebirth. That's a bit, I'm not sure I've phrased it right. I didn't know how else to do it.
So. Okay. So the so what's...
So the subject, the person who has had a direct realization of emptiness...
Okay.
...will not take rebirth in lower realms because they eliminate the cause for lower rebirth.
Okay. So if... So what's the property? Or what's the subject?
Person who's realized
emptiness.
Directly.
Directly. Okay, so Patha Singh, then predicate.
Will not be reborn
in the lower realms. Three, reason?
Because they've eliminated the cause
for lower rebirths. Okay. So then what's the property?
The person who has realized
just directly
has eliminated the causes for rebirth in the lower realms.
They've stopped creating the causes.
Yeah.
They haven't necessarily taken all the seeds out of their mind stream.
They've eliminated the possibility that they'll ripen.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They've eliminated the possibility that they ripen. That's why they won't take a rebirth. Yeah,
which is one of the necessary causes.
Yeah, and actually that happens before the path of seeing, but it's a good thing. Fortitude. I think of the. Of path preparation, yeah. Okay, so then we'll stick with the person on the path of seeing. The person who's realized emptiness directly will not take a rebirth in the lower realms because what's the new reason?
Eliminated the possibility for the seeds for lower rebirths to ripen.
Yeah, because they've eliminated the possibility for the seeds of lower rebirths to ripen.
The subject, the glass, is half empty because of being something that is only half full. Now, is that non-observation or not?
Is that serious?
The subject, the glass, is half empty because of being something that is only half full. Is being half empty, is that non-observation or no?
It's half empty.
It's nature.
Consider that be under nature.
Nature, if it's half full, it's not cause and effect. Yeah. So is it nature or non-observation? Yeah. Because if it's something that is half full is necessarily half empty.
So yeah. All the non-observations are either one or the other of the other two, right?
Yeah, kind of like that.
But half empty is not a negative, is it?
It's only half a negative. Yeah, that's right. It's only half a negative.
It's something.
It's not positive absence. Yeah. I had another one that's kind of funny.
It's suggestive. Like he gave one example that's suggestive. So it is, yeah, like that.
The subject is not the predicate because of being a subject.
Wow.
So you can have the subject and the sign being the same thing, but you can't have the predicate and the sign being the same thing. Is that correct?
Well, you can't really prove something if the subject and the reason are the same thing.
Yeah,
yeah, that's like her first.
He has an example of it in his book, though.
What's the example? The predicate and the reason can't be the same, but the subject and the reason doesn't prove anything either. Yeah, there has.
He showed
to be
him being the
difference.
Same somewhere in here. I remember scoffing at it at the moment.
Yeah.
Can I do another one?
Yeah.
The subject, the selfless, is permanent because it is a group that includes both permanent and impermanent phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
The subject, selfless.
Yeah.
The subject, the selfless, is permanent because it is a group that includes both permanent and impermanent phenomena.
Yeah. And that's because they have this rule that if a group includes both permanent and impermanent, must be permanent. I don't know why they have
that. He explains why in the book.
Why?
He says because otherwise selfless could be impermanent.
Yeah.
Oh, no, no. No, he explains that with existence and non-existence.
Right.
Then later he explains the selfless, but I don't remember how.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the next chapter. Yeah. Okay, so continue making syllogisms for next week.
I was wondering about this, if X is not a barren woman.
If what?
A person X is not a barren woman because Y is her child.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you correctly. If
a person called X is not...
Called X. Oh, okay. A person called X
is not a barren woman because Y is her child.
Is not a barren. Okay. So the person Henrietta
is not a barren
and woman not as a barren woman because
Jane is her child.
Because Jane is a child. That doesn't hold water.
Her child.
Yes.
Okay.
Her biological child. But then I was wondering, like, you know, she could be barren after she gave birth to her child.
Ah.
You can get someone who holds your baby.
Yeah. Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you're pregnant. Yeah. Yeah, so just the presence of the child doesn't prove at this moment that somebody's not a barren woman. But it can prove that throughout their lifetime, they were not a barren woman.
So it's not always a barren woman.
Yeah.
So you could have a barren woman with a child. Because she is now currently barren, but she has a child.
Ah, yeah, we should tell them, yeah. Because maybe she had a hysterectomy after she had a kid. Yeah. So there is a child of a barren woman. Yeah, that's a good one. We should tell them that. Okay, didn't we start this chapter last time?
Which chapter?
Chapter 9? We didn't start it at all. Okay. So here we're getting into basic Buddhist ontology. So some of you remember years ago I made that little 2 or 3 page kind of diagram or list outline of different things, yeah, under the self and then different categories and things like that. Yeah, yeah. So that would come in handy here. What he does, which is interesting, is that one divided it, phenomena or existence into impermanent and permanent. But as we read the chapter, we'll find there's many other ways to divide existence, and that particular thing that I made didn't cover, but it would give you some good introductory thing because some of the categories are synonymous or equivalent, I should say. So if you don't have it, I can send it out. So all the Buddhist tenet systems are goal-oriented systems of philosophy. But I thought we were supposed to marinate in the moment. And that's what my niece says, marinate in the moment. I think that's a good thing, yeah? Rather than be in the moment, marinate in the moment. Okay, you're marinating. Okay, so what's the story here? We're practicing something that's goal-oriented. And at least some traditions of Buddhism are saying, just be here now, you know.
No striving.
Yeah. Huh?
No striving.
No, yeah. Don't push. Yeah, don't be goal-oriented.
Be content to create the causes.
Yeah. Well, some people are almost doing it like, don't even think about creating causes. Just be in the moment. Okay, so what do you think about that, just being in the moment?
Why?
Well, why do people say that, just be in the moment? Because there's lots of traditions that say that. So why are they saying that? And do we say that? Yeah, it's direct perception. But how is direct perception going to get you to enlightenment? If being in the moment, you know, you having sense direct perception. Why are they saying this?
So that you can be mindful of your actions and intentions in the moment and your values and your precepts.
Mm-hmm.
And your goal.
But most people say be in the moment means, you know, I know I'm seeing a pack of tissue. I know I'm closing my computer lid. They say that's being in the moment. Is that the meaning of being in the moment? You know, I'm totally present when closing my computer, turning my computer off. Is that the path to awakening?
Well, that could be practicing to be mindful so that you can use that properly. You're developing a skill, yeah, so that then you can be mindful of your mind.
Yeah, I think your first thing was, it's not just, you know, being mindful that you're turning your computer off. It's, you know, being mindful of your values and your precepts and so on while you're turning your computer off. Being aware of what you're doing for the purpose of not creating negativity. It's not just being aware of what you're doing.
But couldn't being aware of what you're doing be a step in that direction? It's like this is easier to learn to be aware of your physical actions, and then you become aware of your
motivation.
Your
yeah. So it could be a step because it gets you so that you're not lost in the past and you're not lost in the future. So it prevents you from being lost in the past and future. But was just being aware of what you're doing or what is happening. I went to a session by one group when I lived in Boise, and one woman came in and said, you know, I was in the park today and I saw a child playing running around or playing, and it just made me so happy, and I was completely in the present moment watching that child's delight. Yeah, well, that's being in the moment. We're told to be in the moment. So is doing that going to get you to awakening? So what's this whole thing about being in the moment?
I just wanted to add too, like, it's a big part of theater training to be in the moment. We trained very hard to be very, very present on stage so you could perform well. I didn't have any spiritual progress.
Okay.
As in, you need the ethical framework or some kind of spiritual direction for being in the moment, right? Hence, yeah. You have your values, you're being mindful if you have bodhicitta in your mind or if you're, I don't know. Yeah,
just yeah. Out. You have to be in the moment with a certain kind of mind or for a certain purpose for it to become something that's going to lead to have a good result or lead you to awakening. Yeah, just like you said in the theater, you're supposed to be in the moment, be very present, but that didn't bring you any realizations.
I think also, too, being present in the moment, I think would just increase our attachment to the happiness of this life if we didn't really have a more deeper intention on why we were trying to take each moment and live it so presently. Is I could see myself really being quite enamored with the happiness of this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so being in the moment also implies you have to be aware of the impermanent nature of the moment, doesn't it? Because if you aren't aware of the impermanent nature of the moment, then the attachment's going to arise. So it's not just being, yeah?
I think that practice is used some in psychology, not for a spiritual purpose, but to get people to get away from so much conceptuality so they get out of the narratives, that the stories that we tell ourselves all the time that make us miserable. And in that regard, I think it's been quite successful.
Yeah, yeah. So in the sense of stopping people from horrendous conceptualizations about the past and the present, that's very good, you know. So it may prevent the creation of negative karma, but will it create the cause for your spiritual goals? No, you need a certain motivation behind it and a certain way of doing it. Yeah.
The idea is that you can only experience the nature of reality in the present moment and in a non-conceptual way. But right. To get to that point, you have to know a lot.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
They kind of just leave out the whole.
Our ultimate goal is, you know, non-conceptual in the moment. But to do that, you have to train with a lot of conceptuality first. Yeah.
I think the example that you give is an illustration of the teachings where concentration is not just a purely Buddhist practice.
To concentration is not?
A purely Buddhist practice. You can be a non-Buddhist and have concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ethically neutral. So you can kill with a lot of concentration and mindfulness.
Mm-hmm. Although I think they usually say that, I mean, if you have the dhyana, then that's a virtuous object. But you can develop states of concentration before that. Yeah. But again, it would be in the continuum of a person with that concentration. Because if they were in meditation session, they wouldn't be killing at that moment. They wouldn't be moving. So you'd have to say the continuum of a person. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious too, if you think the idea of being in the moment helps with kind of accepting where you are in your practice. I asked this because I asked someone, what are your spiritual goals for this year? Right, they're taking time off of work. And then they said, to attain first jhana. but I don't have expectations. I was like, what do I write back?
That's my goal, but I don't have expectations.
Yeah, or to have direct realization of non-self. And I thought, oh dear, I just remembered, so like, you know, the stories you tell us about the spiritual goals you set for yourself, I've always found very helpful, like with your brother asking you, what's your goal in 5 years? To be a kinder person. I'm like, okay, I can buy off on that.
Yeah.
That I can work towards. Uh-huh. I don't know. So I'm, you know, when we talk about a goal-oriented system, if you get into that whole, like, yeah, first jhana by December.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be difficult. But they do say, you know, when you generate bodhicitta, try to attain awakening in this life, but don't expect it. So there's a difference between your goal to be to try to attain something and your goal being to attain it. Yeah. Yeah. But you're right. When you have a specific goal like that, then you're going to drive yourself crazy. It's like, oh, it's December 29. I'm still, you know, I haven't even gotten to the, yeah, still thinking about peace. I haven't even gotten to the second stage of sustained attention, you know. So that's an interesting thing. And I think, you know, and I stopped here to talk about it because so many people say this. And I think when people say that to us, or people ask us about it, we should be able to answer in an intelligent way. Yeah. In other words, does Buddhism mean, yeah, you're in the present moment, so you don't have any plans, you don't have any goals. Yeah. I mean, and when you hear like Dzogchen, you know, give up thoughts of the past, give up thoughts of the future, does that mean you never think about the past and future? You know, you're going to be a mess. Yeah? Yeah, it's going to be kind of messy. You remember Miriam?
Yes.
Yeah? So, you know, she got quite senile. And one time, Janet, her daughter, brought her over and we were visiting. And I always loved Miriam. She was like my absentee mother or something. But Janet said, she's on one time zone. You know, it's the present. And whatever, you know, it is, it's now. It's not the past. It's not the future. And so it's interesting talking with someone when there's only the one time zone of the moment. Yeah. Yeah, so you can see it does pull you out of all that conceptualization about the past and future. But, you know, yeah, for what purpose? You have to have a purpose for doing that. It's a good purpose, but, you know, is it just, yeah, yeah. I don't know that our kiddies think much about the past and future. Yeah.
Unless it's dinner time.
Huh?
Unless it's dinner time.
Yes. Yes. Then it's thinking a lot about the future. Okay. So all the Buddhist tenet systems are goal-oriented systems of philosophy. They are presented for the sake of laying out clearly a definitive and final explanation of what exists in order to inform practitioners about the nature of things. They do not undertake to discover what exists for the sake of knowledge alone. Rather, they proceed with the assumption that the knowledge of what exists will liberate. So this is a big difference between Buddhists and scientists. Yeah? His Holiness always talks about the similarities. Both want knowledge. Yeah? And both want to learn. And he does attribute, you know, science, you know, the goal to making the world a better place. But that's, I think, for some scientists. Some scientists, it's just the intellectual curiosity that is motivating them. And even if it is, the motivation is to make the world a better place, there isn't the idea of liberation. But certainly it doesn't hurt anybody at all to make the world a better place. Okay? You notice that after you talk debate, then every time you read a sentence, it's like, yeah, that sentence really, you know. I remember after teaching this class once, I went to write a letter, and it's like, well, I can't write this letter, you know. Yeah. I had a friend, one of my old friends in Dharamsala. He's a layperson, but he did all the training in the dialectic school. And he told me at one point he had a relationship with a woman, but it just wasn't working because everything she said he would take issue with. So, you know, that isn't a correct syllogism. That doesn't make any sense. He said the relationship didn't go very well. Yeah. That's interesting. Thus, the first thing to do is to lay out the basic understanding of what exists and what does not exist, as described in the system of philosophy that serves as the basis for Buddhist reasoning and debate. However, for our purposes here, remember that you do not have to believe this stuff in order to get on with learning Buddhist reasoning and debate. Very true, but, you know, then you're losing your whole purpose. Of course, I find the descriptions very compelling, I admit, but you do not have to. Rather, and actually, this is helpful because when you get into how they talk about some of the sense objects and the division, the types of sounds, the types of flavors and stuff like this, and colors, it's like, it's so different from our way of doing it, and or even their view of the elements, you know, everything, you know, you have a molecule of earth and a molecule of water and stuff like that. So it is true, you don't have to believe everything. Because, yeah, you know, you'll remember when Geshe Thakke was here, and so many of the refutations in Aryadeva were about partless particles. Yeah? So do you believe in partless particles? You know, maybe after all those refutations you start to. I don't know. But you know, it's interesting in those times, even though the basic way they're setting things out, we may not believe, but the way the argument is created is very helpful, and what it's getting us to think about is helpful. Okay, so we can leave that sentence in. Oh, so now you have somebody who's teaching, who's going through a debate book, who's also an editor reading something. I can't read anything nowadays, you know, without my mind. No, better to word it this way. Okay. Of course, I find the descriptions very compelling, I admit, but you do not have to. Rather, you just need to understand how these terms are used in this system of reasoning in order to understand the examples and the entire presentation in this book. Once you have done that, you will be able to apply the style of reasoning to whatever you are interested in. In fact, the entirety of the analytical system presented here could be expressed in terms of mathematics, biology, law, medicine, or any field in which there are clear definitions. So you can see by what he's saying that his audience for this book is not necessarily Buddhist practitioners. It's, you know, people who are interested in how Buddhist reasoning works. What's more, if you just take the Buddhist ontology, their theory of what exists that is presented here to be definitive, that approach is not even in accordance with the advice of the Buddha, who is quoted as saying, like gold that is acquired upon being scorched, cut, and rubbed, my word is to be adopted by monastics and scholars upon analyzing it well, not out of respect for me. So very important thing that we're supposed to question, we're supposed to ask. You know, and you'll remember in Precious Garland that Nagarjuna said that people who do not ask questions of the wise will be born dumb. Okay. In using the example of checking whether or not a piece of ore is genuine gold, the Buddha is indicating that there is a great deal at stake here. As a person in business is careful about money, so religious seekers must take care about where they put their trust. This means that you should check a person's words, even the words of the Buddha, very carefully, rather than just taking them on faith. Since the South Asian approach to spirituality is that we are liberated through understanding the nature of things, someone else's words can be helpful only if those words are accurate. Moreover, even if the description is completely accurate, merely being able to repeat the words describing reality will not be actual wisdom, so that too would not help. Thus, the Buddha gives a warning. Merely knowing the words of the Buddha is not knowledge. Rather, the advice is to take note of the words and check them closely. Then you may gain knowledge. So this is important. Just knowing the words is not our goal. Okay, we have to check if the words are accurate. We have to check, but we have to actually look if the meaning is accurate. That's what we really have to look at. Okay. So he says the advice is to take note of the words and check them closely. Yeah, by seeing if the meaning is accurate or not. And in that way, we'll gain knowledge. It's not just about remembering the word. Yeah. And I want to add something, because Venerable Dhamcha sent me a... Do you want to describe what you sent me? What's happening in Singapore? Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so basically Ling Rinpoche is going to be giving 3 days of puja in Singapore, and all of them are like initiations. He's not giving Dharma teachings, is what I can see. It's going to be at the casino hotel where you can see like zillions of people. Anyone can come for free. And he's giving doing Hayagriva puja, Hayagriva initiation, and then Dorje Namjom.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's sad because without requesting teachings on these topics, I don't see the benefit of taking the initiations. Yeah. And it's going to just bring a lot of people who are there for a cultural experience, maybe. I don't know.
For good luck.
Getting some kind of blessing and magical thinking.
Basically. Yeah, yeah. A lot of magical thinking, because the pujas will all be done in Tibetan. My hope is that they'll let Rinpoche teach a little bit before each puja. But we don't know, because the whole schedule is just pujas, and then the last bit every day there's a jainang. Yeah? And, it's just so sad, because Rinpoche has so much to offer, and people can learn so much, and that's what they're scheduling. But that people like that, and it raises a lot of funds. But they do get some Dharma imprint, and they do meet Rinpoche, so that's good. So maybe in future lives that will ripen, and they'll be able to learn something from him. Okay. So you want to call that Dharma Center, and don't you understand who's coming there,
It's just interesting, such a young teacher that he would have a group of advisors that they're agreeing to this.
Yeah, but the thing is, the way things work is the people who invite him request certain things, yeah? And as a High Lama, he's also under a lot of pressure to bring resources to the monastery. So in that way, the monks get the resources they need and people get some good imprints on their mind. Yeah, and a lot of people come for that. If he were teaching, they wouldn't come. But that's what His Holiness would call degeneration. Yeah, some of you may have been, remember when he taught in Mountain View some years ago? He taught the Heart Sutra, and then on the last day, he gave the medicine Buddha Jainang, And the whole meadow and back was filled with people, and His Holiness said, it should not be like this. Yeah, everybody should come for the teachings, and a very few people come for the Jhenang. He was quite sharp. More off topic, by the way. Yes?
You sort of answered my question when you said His Holiness would say it's degeneration. I was wondering if other lamas would feel differently, and if anybody in the Tibetan community is going to speak out about this, saying it's not good or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, His Holiness does, but yeah, just because Your Holiness doesn't mean everybody's going to listen to you. That's a sign of non-observation. Yeah. Okay, so maybe we have to stop here. But you see, we're people who really appreciate the Dharma, you know? When you have just people who are curious and going for a pizzazz or whatever, then this is what will attract them.
But like you were saying too, yeah, it has to do with the students knowing how to request and what will be beneficial.
Yeah.
And I think like we met people who in the last year in Malaysia who had taken all these initiations without understanding them, and it brings a lot of harm to your practice. That's what really struck me. That's one. Mm-hmm. And two, I was thinking if you hold an event like this in a casino hotel, it just reflects very poorly on Buddhism in general.
I know.
Like in Singapore, many Buddhists were strongly opposed to the building of that casino.
Yeah.
Because it's against, many religious people were.
Yeah.
So to me, it's very weird.
And yeah. So surely they should have other conference venues.
I think it is the biggest one now. So,
oh.
Yeah. Okay, and I have a request from the community. But
and then people could go gamble afterwards.
I just in this moment flashed on another side of that was I took the forearm Chenrezig initiation from His Holiness in Seattle in 1992 mm-hmm. before I was a Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quite certain that the seeds that were yeah. touched there has, mm-hmm. you know, is a reason I'm sitting here. Mm-hmm. So there's also that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you have seeds from yeah. before, yeah. then, yeah, they could get ripened in that way. Yeah.
I have a separate question for everyone. Mm-hmm. Because when we were trying to do the correct effect signs, and you told us to try and prove something positive, right? So I was trying to do one about making progress in my Dharma practice.
Okay.
So, no, I'm not going to read it. But I'm just curious if that's something other people might think about. Like, can we make syllogisms that show ourselves we have progressed? And what would those be?
Yeah. So let's do that for next yeah, yeah, week, yeah. okay?
Yeah.
I mean, still some more of the three kinds of syllogisms, but let's try and do some positive ones instead of proving how bad we are. You know, when the monks do the shows and the song and dance things, who have said they went and they were so moved by the ceremonies that then they decided to investigate Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that definitely can happen. So let's hope it happens to all the people yeah. who go. That they, and so that next time they all want to hear teachings from Rinpoche.